which is both morally correct and unpleasantly Puritan, and itself corrupt. The murder Donatello performs for Miriam is expiated in a dungeon. His fawn-like nature is imprisoned, his crime is atoned. But there remains an eternal imprisonment for the crime, which is self-imposed. Through Kenyon, Hawthorne intimates that this is a form of puritanical warning against European excess. He turns his last pair of lovers into sterile, stoically noble remains. His moral sentimentality is both racist and heartless. In chapter 11, Miriam and Donatello are intoxicated by the dancing and music in the Borghese Gardens, the intoxication of art and the body's movement to art. But Hilda and Kenyon do not even feel an inclination to take part. Hilda, in white, is bewildered by the gaiety, and Kenyon is simply outside it. Even the mysterious stranger, Miriam's model, takes part in the dancing, even if he has been introduced in ways parallel to Chillingworth's hold over Dimmesdale, that is, in ways which Hawthorne thought of as the unpardonable sin. Like Melville's cold, evil men, the mysterious stranger is given as the destructive element in natural existence. I quote, "An influence such as beasts and reptiles of subtle and evil nature sometimes exercise upon their victims." But again, Hawthorne withholds the reasons for his mysterious control over Miriam, this tie, as it's called, between them. It's presented simply as some kind of impersonal fate. And the language is of that kind, fate, destiny, the labyrinth of midnight paths, entangled fates, the crimson stain on Miriam's efforts towards a new life through her three friends, and so on. But beside the effect of phrases like an odour of guilt and scent of blood about her, Miriam holds also a hint of Lady Macbeth in her character, although it is Donatello's words which are reminiscent of Lady Macbeth's sleepwalking words. "It looks very white," he says of her hand, "but I have known hands as white, which all the water in the ocean would not have washed clean." As an embodiment for the term evil, this activity is completely insufficient. The quality of the action remains gothic, mystificatory, and merely atmospherically suggestive. When the ambience is finally resolved at the end of the novel, Miriam is found to be guiltless of any immoral act prior to her usage of Donatello, and Hawthorne attempts to make this plot a demonstration of original sin, which by absurd definition no one ever originally commits, but is simply born with. At the level of plot, the motivating act is more like moral blackmail executed by the model, distinct murder committed by Donatello out of passion, self-torture in Miriam, and a pattern of penitences, chatter about destiny, deliberate sexual unhappiness, and the substitution of moral high-mindedness for what human beings are actually capable of. The growth of sensibility from natural to sinful is altogether too schematic and doctrinaire. The marble faun deteriorates into theology. The reasons for it reach into Hawthorne's struggle against uncertainty. After her confrontation with the model in chapter 10, Miriam seeks the calm coolness, I quote the phrase, of Kenyon, the man of marble, as he's called. Now, far from being another type of the man seeking the Gorgon's head of the absolute, or the direction of Melville's stone man, Pierre, Kenyon is the unfeverish man who, unlike the Italian count, Donatello, recognizes Hilda's high, lonely life. Hilda is not in need of love. In her, Miriam sees the type of women, I quote, "distinguished in art, literature, and science, but isolated from men." A crude simplification of the structure of character compared with the complexity of Hester Prynne. Kenyon's woman takes the form of his sculptured Cleopatra. But in the marble form, she has none of Shakespeare's complexity, much more of Dryden's schematization. She's simply the type of Hawthorne's dark, sensuous woman, combining the original sin of sexual love with the unpardonable sin of tyranny over another human life. But the form is that of a slightly ridiculous femme fatale in the late 19th century manner, affording a pleasurable fear out of the fantasy of sexually dominating women. Miriam partakes of this coarseness of characterology, as if Hawthorne had grafted the Johnsonian method of Dickens onto the destiny plot of George Eliot's Daniel Deronda, in order to make symbolic fiction of retribution against passion. The blood-red carbuncle ruby which he uses for Miriam is too static a symbol of sensuous value. I quote, "My secret is no precious pearl, but my dark red carbuncle, red as blood, is too rich a gem to put in a stranger's casket." After the crime, this reappears as Kenyon's image for her transformation. In place of Hester's scarlet A, we have Miriam's scarlet tumorous stone. Something glimmered with a clear red luster like the stars in a southern sky. Somehow or other, this coloured light seemed an emanation of herself, as if all that was passionate and glowing in her native disposition had crystallized on her breast, and was just now scintillating more brilliantly than ever in sympathy with some emotion of her heart. She has in fact become an aristocratic tragedienne in A Tragedy of Blood. But Hawthorne also requires his characters to reach beyond impulsive determinism. Three of his main characters are artists, because he needs to include in his plot the degree of penetrative insight associated with the artistic career. The resemblance between an Italian artist's sketch of a demon and Miriam's sketches of her sinister model is intended to be an example of the artist's penetration to the permanent core of evil. This appears in chapter 15. Without, of course, the artist necessarily being able to convert insight into personal action. Miriam's inability to recognize the similarity, that is, between the Italian artist's sketch of the demon and her own sketches of the sinister model, is to be the analogue of her blindness to the danger near her. Even if she is allowed to try to exorcise the personal demon with water from the Fountain of Trevi, chapter 16. But this is little more than medieval superstition transferred to 19th century melodrama. In the Colosseum, Hawthorne recalls Benvenuto Cellini's famous experience of demons, but only to create the model who is praying there before the Christian shrines to the Roman victims of the arena as both demonic spectre and penitent. Donatello will appear in the same condition after his crime, a penitent pilgrim. But at this point, the model's action causes, I quote, "a brief fit of madness" in Miriam. A mad woman concentrating the elements of a long insanity into that instant. The blackness of the evil, is Hawthorne's word, and her woe, is linked with the ancient dust, as he calls it, of the arena. And the novel at this point is propelled towards Donatello's own sacrificial act. His innocence, in fact, will become the victim of Miriam's past. The act itself is the climax of the plot, and as usual with Hawthorne, the visual location is a moral location. The edge of a precipice and the Tarpeian rock. The former is the place where the Roman Curtius experienced prophetic visions of the fall of Rome. This is given in chapter 18. The visions he had dated back as far as the foreign invasions. I've dated forward as far as the foreign invasions of the 19th century. And after his visions, he himself fell to his death in the chasm. I quote, "the pit of blackness that lies beneath us everywhere." To resist their involvement in the Roman bloodshed of the past under their feet, Kenyon, Hilda, and Miriam in one of the most startlingly and unintentionally funny scenes in American literature, sing Hail Columbia at the top of their voices as a moonlight exorcism of European wickedness. Even Miriam finds it a relief, but it can only be temporary, since, like his character Miriam, Hawthorne believes that happiness is an illusory crust over the pit of evil. That word crust is his own. Miriam finds a less comical symbol of salvation in the Capitoline statue of Marcus Aurelius, a father figure, as she says, a rightful king at whose feet lay her heart. Kenyon, the cool American, scoffs at this abject subservience, and the religious Puritan descendant, Hilda, finds it repugnant, as she does later, by the way, the human action in St. Peter's Church. The second location, the Tarpeian Rock, is where Roman traitors were thrown to their deaths, an instance of the fall from, I quote, the utmost height of ambition to its profoundest ruin. For Miriam, it's a temptation to suicide. For Donatello, it's a vertiginous fascination. The model appears once again, and once again Hawthorne withholds what the, I quote, unspeakable evil of his persecution might be. Ironically, when Donatello kills the model in the Tarpeian tradition for traitors, Miriam is only half conscious, unable to distinguish, I quote, whether she were really an actor and sufferer in the scene. It's Hilda who witnesses the murder in full consciousness, although only by chance. And this is Hawthorne fulfilling his program for the penetrative insight of innocence and its movement towards experience. Hawthorne impatiently records Donatello's transformation immediately. I quote, a fierce energy inspired him. It kindled him into a man. It developed within him an intelligence. And this pattern destroys forever, I quote, the former simple and joyous creature. This is chapter 19. So where Melville's Pierre was calcified by the action of the absolute, the marble fawn is drawn into warmth. Donatello is inspired by Miriam's assertion that in Roman times, I quote, innocent persons were saved by the destruction of a guilty one who deserved his doom. And her eyes had seemed to confirm it as a principle to be obeyed. And after its fulfillment, she seals the act. My heart consented to what you did. And then, guilt, I quote, like the coil of a serpent, knots them together by its terrible contractile power, closer than a marriage bond. That term, contractile, includes both the action of contraction and the action of contract or law. Hawthorne wishes to make the guilt inevitable law and transfiguring intimacy at the same time. And his sinisterly parodic language translates the idea of the outlaw beyond its immediate social meaning to a universal moral condition. I quote, this is still chapter 19, so intimate in those first moments was the union that it seemed as if their new sympathy annihilated all other ties, that they were released from the chain of humanity. A new sphere, a special law, had been created for them alone. The world could not come near them. They were safe. Their transcendent condition has the tone of the unity of Hester and Dimmesdale in the forest scene of The Scarlet Letter. That is the pattern of outlawry. The deepest union between a man and a woman in Hawthorne's vision comes from the transgression of law, whether it is the Puritan law of marriage or the more universal law against murder. But Hawthorne is also restating his obsession with superior intelligence and heart transfigured into a state beyond society and social law, into a condition of safety beyond the tensions of conventional morality, and shifted into an area almost angelic in its absence of conflict conditions and complete self-containment. The state of Miriam and Donatello is so transcendent that it becomes for them passionate innocence, which rids the world of an evil, a kind of rebirth. I'm quoting here. They flung the past behind them, as she counseled, or else distilled from it a fiery intoxication which sufficed to carry them triumphantly through those first moments of their doom. For guilt has its moment of rapture too. The foremost result of a broken law is ever an ecstatic sense of freedom. And thus they exhaled upward out of their dark sympathy, at the base of which lay a human corpse, a bliss or an insanity which the unhappy pair imagined to be well worth the sleepy innocence that was forever lost to them. Passion lent them, as it does to meaner shapes, its brief nobility of carriage. They trod through the streets of Rome as if they too were among the majestic and guilty shadows that from ages long gone by have haunted the blood-stained city. The line of ecstasy through transgression moves in American literature, in American and social art, from the Marble Faun right through to Bonnie and Clyde. American and European literature is saturated with it, and Hawthorne's terms are accurately ambivalent, placing, I quote, ecstatic sense of freedom, dark sympathy, moment of rapture, bliss, insanity, nobility, in the context of historical tragedy, by which murder is condoned by the condition of the guilty. It's a steady element in what has been called tragedy. Transgression of law followed by ecstatic union of bodies, as if law were the necessary boundary to be broken in order to reach intimate oneness, and nobility the condition of outlawry. The consecration of adulterous love in Hester and Dimmesdale becomes in the Marble Faun a consecration in guilt without mutual love, since Miriam's love for Donatello follows the murder. Miriam and Donatello, as Europeans, join the European past in their lack of innocence and fallen ecstasy. I quote, shut out of heaven, to use Hawthorne's Miltonic phrase. Hilda retreats to her virgin white tower, asking, am I too stained with guilt? This is chapter 23. As Hawthorne inaugurates his new theme of the responsibility of the witness of crime or sin of friends, she too, at least temporarily, is shut out of heaven. I quote, his point is this, that by her witness, and here's the quotation, Adam falls anew, and paradise, heretofore in unfaded bloom, is lost again, and closed forever, with the fiery swords gleaming at its gates. Immediately Hilda looks again at her portrait of Beatrice Cenci, and reassures herself of her own innocence. She repels Miriam's powerful magnetism as a threat which would, I quote, discolour her own pure white atmosphere. Those are Hawthorne's phrases. But Miriam exposes cruel Puritan selfishness and angelism in Hilda. I always said, Hilda, that you were merciless, for I had a perception of it even while you loved me best. You have no sin, nor any conception of what it is, and therefore you are so terribly severe. As an angel, you are not amiss, but as a human creature and a woman among earthly men and women, you need a sin to soften you. This judgment on virgin aristocratism, on what Melville calls marbleization, is repeated by Kenyon later in chapter 42. Hilda, however, cannot escape. She had in fact seen the passion pass between Miriam and Donatello. Now she tries to, I quote, shut out the recollection of this, another quotation, this dark secret. In doing so, she becomes absolutely alone. Even Kenyon's suspected love means to her that she cannot turn to him as a friend, although Miriam suspects that the shot will bring his love properly to birth later on. The crime reverberates in every way, and Hawthorne's sentences, every crime destroys more Edens than our own. Now halfway through his plot, Hawthorne develops the moral locality of Hilda's tower in the middle of Rome by moving to Donatello's tower in the Umbrian countryside, the estate to which the Count has retreated. His first imprisonment, self-imposed and high above the world of Monte Beni, the last of his noble lineage. And when Kenyon comes to see him, the two men partake in a pre-Hemingway Bacchic wine ritual, drinking a local wine called Sunshine, a secret wine, we're told, which to drink was really more a moral than a physical enjoyment. It's a curiously Puritan American punishment, outlawry, social and moral alienation, and unconvincing, because unfounded on fact in the novel. Since we still do not know what the model threat to Miriam's life was, nor does Kenyon, nor apparently does Donatello. What Hawthorne called romance here reaches an impossible degree of abstraction. The ennoblement of Donatello under the bronze Pope's benediction in a later chapter is a symbolism without historical or psychologically sufficient evidence. In the last 14 chapters and the postscript, Hawthorne had the opportunity to set out the evidence. He refuses to do so. The scene is Rome, imaged as, I quote, a long decaying corpse. Chapter 36 opens with a tirade against the city which surrounds Hilda, who now takes the central interest. Hawthorne uses his favourite imagery for her state of guilt and despair, a torpor heretofore unknown to her vivacious though quiet temperament, had possessed itself of the poor girl like a half-dead serpent knotting its cold, inextricable wreaths about her limbs. Hilda is overcome by a confrontation with evil in persons formerly loved and trusted. A corpse lies in the spring of her heart, we're told, a recurrent image of pollution in Hawthorne. She is imprisoned by, quote, the old masters she is tied to copying. More tyranny of the past, adding to her torpor, and the word is repeated again. Her insight into their work has left her. Art now wearies her with its idealism, and she falls into that condition of ennui very familiar in 19th century romantic literature. She begins to appreciate the truth, rather, as she calls it, rather than hollow aesthetic beauty. She becomes, in fact, a critic. Art loses its, I quote, consecration. She feels herself in exile in Rome. But she is drawn explicitly to Kenyon for the first time. It's as if Hawthorne is saying that she can't fall in love until she becomes an art critic. Her solitude is broken, but her education begins, parallel to Donatello's. This New England girl, Hilda, is now in her alienation attracted to the Roman Catholic Church through its aesthetic apparatus. This is a common theme in the 19th century, of course. The Puritan in Hawthorne is sceptical about this Catholic machinery, is his word, to which Hilda makes her pilgrimage. And again, the word pilgrimage is used, and again it parallels Donatello's. But Hawthorne concedes that, unlike the Protestant who, I quote, would have kept all that torture pent up in his heart and let it burn there till it seared him into indifference, the Catholic is able to exteriorize his pain. And this is the basis of the appeal to Hilda. But Hawthorne makes her escape from St. Peter's, Rome, and its monstrous artistic egoism. She crushes herself with holy water, in a spirit of contradicting her Puritan ancestors. She breaks down in prayer to any god or saint who might listen. She confesses in, I quote, the world's cathedral, in a state of hysteria, to an American priest of 50 years' exile in Rome. Which is the most beautiful kind of confusion, as if you're trying to get the plot in all ways. It's sort of cunning but cheap at the same time, it's all good. She confesses to him that about the crime she had witnessed, only to discover, I quote, and here Hawthorne is beginning to plot very carefully, that the authorities of Rome know of it already. And as she accepts the old man's blessing, she says, I am a daughter of the Puritans. And her virgin whiteness starts to return. To Kenyon, she has, I quote, flung her angelic purity into that mass of unspeakable corruption, the Roman Church. And it is this, he says, which comes between a man and, I quote, the pure white light of heaven. But he recovers his common sense in time, at least to make love to her a little. Hilda's return to her virgin dovecot shrine and her reluctance to love coincide. But now she begins restlessly searching for images of the adequate virgin, saviour or saint to copy throughout the bitter cold Roman winter. She notices at one point the look of, I quote, growing intellectual power and moral sense in Kenyon's bust of Donatello. In fact, the change has taken place in her. But the moral relationship of Miriam and Donatello remains willfully, I quote, a mystery to her. She remains, in fact, a severe virgin judge. Hawthorne now draws his book to a close with a last mysterious action. To atone for her hardness toward Miriam, Hilda delivers a small package for her to the Palazzo Cenci in, I quote, the foulest and ugliest part of Rome, on the edge of the Jewish ghetto, resembling, I quote, that of maggots when they overpopulate a decaying cheese. Hawthorne is obsessed by the uncleanness rather than the suffering. Hilda walks in the corruption as if, I quote, innocence continued to make a paradise around itself and keep itself still unfallen. So the Cenci association with Miriam is again brought forward. Hilda vanishes into the Palazzo Cenci, symbol of the corrupt past in Europe. But through this captivity, she ironically enters the world, the Roman carnival, and the offered love of Kenyon. It is very barely plotted in a welter of symbols and moralizing, but this is Hawthorne's intention. The lamp in the shrine of Hilda's tower, the consecrated and legendary flame, as he calls it, is extinguished, I quote, for the first time in centuries. So this seems to be a gratuitous piece of would-be symbolism, but apart from that, the plot is in fact quite well handled. Kenyon begins his hunt for Hilda in Rome. Again, the familiar imagery, the labyrinth city of evil. And it's here that Hawthorne's loathing is most obvious and over-insistent. All the way through these sections, it's very clear that the language is highly emotional. The old priest tells him he will see Hilda transfigured, I quote, clad in the shining white robe of the true faith. Kenyon begins to imagine Hilda kidnapped by wicked Jesuits who make her permanently succumb to the scarlet superstitions. It's Hawthorne's Freud. And Hawthorne is not being ironical here, unfortunately, although he is showing Kenyon's own New England coldness in the process of change. The sculptor finds out in the Campania the buried figure of a marble woman overgrown with soil. A Venus he rescues from the past. But Hilda is more important to him than art now. Another point which Hawthorne is dramatizing just here. Among the excavations at this particular place outside Rome, Miriam and Donatello, dressed as country people, the costume of their redemption from the labyrinth of the city, as well as the Roman carnival, make their appearance. I quote, their stern and black reality is temporarily held off with one more day in the wild freedom of this sweet-scented air. But their gaiety is hysterical. And Miriam, in her emotional release, at last gets the facts rather than the moral myth of her life. So we have, by the very end of the book, the center of the metaphysical structure, rather than the poetic symbols for it. Miriam, as Hawthorne hinted, is in fact English, Jewish, Italian, partly of noble birth, wealthy, and connected with a, quote, terrible event, unquote, a few years back, which had shocked Kenyon, along with most people. She had in fact been betrothed in an arranged marriage as a girl, but, like Hester Prynne, she has the spirit of freedom in her. And Hawthorne's image is the traditional one of blood. There was something in Miriam's blood, in her mixed race, in her recollections of her mother, some characteristic, finally, in her own nature, which has given her freedom of thought and force of will. And that's all we get. Like Chillingworth, in fact, Miriam's proposed husband has an evil quality. I quote, traits so evil, so treacherous, so wild, and yet so strongly subtle, as could only be accounted for by the insanity which often develops itself in old, close-kept races of men, when long unmixed with new blood. Here again is Hawthorne's confrontation of the free, sensuous woman and the old world of male-dominated society, but presented at the level of broad psychological moral character and racism. Facts do not emerge from Miriam and the destined husband she repudiates when the contract comes up for fulfillment. Then the unstated fatal event occurred, which leaves Miriam somewhat tainted but innocent. The model, given no more concretely than the criminal event. Insanity must have been mixed up with it, says Hawthorne, with his original composition. Acts of depravity, which he suggested, remorse, dark career, penitence, which often seems to go hand in hand with crime, and severe and self-inflicted penance, and then his fake acquired reputation of unusual sanctity. Hawthorne keeps up the whole business, swathed in mystery and twilight gloom and conjecture, except for two things. First, the model. As Miriam says, my persecutor had gone thither, that is, to a convent, for penance, but followed me forth with fresh impulses to crime. He had me in his power. Mad as he was and wicked as he was, with one word he could have blasted me in the belief of all the world. His power, therefore, is to isolate Miriam in the world of sin and power in the old world. Secondly, the association with the Cenci story is clearly an inference of sexual sin here. Beatrice Cenci's incestuous relationship with her father, Count Cenci, for which disobedience her father punished her by imprisonment. But Hawthorne's reluctance to come out with the facts leaves Miriam simply a dark woman to whom he imputes natural sensuality, itself a source of both crime and masculine intelligence in Donatello. Was the murder of the monk model a blessing in disguise as a crime? I quote, a means of education reached under no other discipline. Is Hawthorne saying that the past can only be atoned for and changed by further crime? Miriam delights in the mystery of Adam's fall as the analogy of Donatello's necessary fall. The destined means, it's called, to attain a higher, brighter, and profounder happiness than our lost birthright gave. Like Hester Prynne, to a certain extent, she's a late 19th century speculative free mind, attempting beyond Roman and Protestant Christianity to rationalize the meaning of the fall myth. I quote, will not this idea account for the permitted existence of sin, as no other theory can? Sin has become so beneficently handled by omniscience and omnipotence that whereas our dark enemy sought to destroy us by it, it has really become an instrument most effective in the education of intellect and soul. Kenyon refuses to enter this dangerous ground. As he said, mortal man has no right. And it is a heresy, since it repudiates all evil in the version of transcendental power transforming every act for final human good, and therefore an equivocal denial of the existence of a fixed concept of evil, Christian or any other, except the evil of the tyrannous restrictions of one person by another, that is, the unpardonable sin. The trouble is that the extreme point of such power would be murder. and this Hawthorne hasn't realized. Donatello's murder releases Miriam from the model monk's power by imprisoning the model monk in death and himself in guilt, from which no earthly justice can be expected to exonerate him. Hawthorne reaches the extreme point of his dramatizations of the law and freedom, the dialectic between the two of them, in the form of an equivocal equation masked in picturesque symbolism of the Gothic and the 17th century Christian traditions. That should, I think, be Miltonic tradition. That's better. Kenyon accepts none of this, and in chapters 48 and 49, he's seen as the American Protestant outsider, in contrast to his former role as a moral mediator. He is now the butt of the Roman carnival crowd because of his bewildered, solitary unhappiness. The carnival is given as an effort to regain the youth and light-heartedness of Adam in paradise. But Kenyon cannot imitate Donatello and dance in the corso as he did in the previous carnival. He watches the sport and sees it carried on as a battle from the sidelines. Hawthorne's attitude towards the unleashed Roman crowd is deeply sceptical, acknowledging the release, but fearful of the unchained tiger, as he calls it, and noticing the courtesy in the sacredness of the festival, which goes on at the same time. License, he says, strictly limited. And freedom, he says, under control. But he's worried. I quote, "Everybody seemed lawless. Nobody was rude. If any reveller overstepped the mark, it was sure to be no Roman, but an Englishman or an American." Kenyon becomes, in fact, at this point, the Puritan melancholic, assailed by rough maskers disguised as a rout, like that of Comus. And once again, the Comus rout appears in Hawthorne, as it did in The Blight of the Romans. What is called his merry martyrdom reaches a climax with a gigantic female figure parodying rejected love to the point of firing a pistol at his chest. But it explodes like a pop gun, leaving Kenyon covered in lime dust. The beast figures surround him in monstrous mock sympathy of an assassinated man. Kenyon resigns himself to, I quote, "this feverish dream, passive, unresisting, saying farewell to his two masked guilty friends in the whirl of the carnival in the midst of which they are arrested." Perhaps Hawthorne does see Kenyon ironically, since he is at this point hit by a cauliflower, which is immediately followed by a rosebud from Hilda, who now appears masked in white above him. Whether one's supposed to take seriously a man who's hit successively by a cauliflower and a rosebud is a moot point, of course. Maybe Hawthorne gave up at this point, I really don't know. But we're only told that Hilda is in fact undergone, I quote, "a transfiguration," which has to do with a further experience of the great masters of painting. And in the last chapter, chapter 50, Hawthorne says he wishes his reader not to analyze, I quote, "the web of his symbolic events, but to gain a full overall effect." Hilda is very secret about her disappearance, that is, Hawthorne is, into the hands of religious and governmental power, that's his word. Kenyon repeats Miriam's earlier suggestion of the utility of sin for human maturity, rejected by Hilda as a mockery of Orthodox belief. They both begin to yearn for home, as some kind of stasis away from all the speculation induced by their guilty friends. Miriam leaves Hilda as a gift of an Etruscan bracelet, the Etruscans being pre-Roman Italians living in the Umbrian and Tuscan landscape. And it's seven ancient jewels from seven sepulchres form a sort of circle of sadness which Hilda assumes. In a postscript, the author appears himself in the book with Hilda and Kenyon in Rome on top of St. Peter's. Kenyon informs him, that is Hawthorne, of the condition of Miriam's apparently, I quote, free and self-controlled life. Her privacy and isolated life is maintained through the administration of Rome, the priestly rulers, they're called, which are the very ones, of course, who have put Hilda in a convent for her own safety, and who now keep Donatello in a dungeon of the castle of St. Angelo. And there the whole piece ends with a coy reference to that cruelly imprisoned man's ears, which were furry. Hawthorne's romance then bursts through the Gothic or symbolic framework and moves towards the condition of a Jamesian plot of the analytic growth of the soul. But the symbolic method is not modified sufficiently, and the analysis of motive comes up against intolerable mystification of the plot. An ambitious, fascinating, but finely dislocated work, concluding in a frivolous fog. The centre of the dislocation is Hawthorne's reluctance or refusal or inability to handle sexual materials clearly, and mystification of magnetic influences, colour symbolism, literary and artistic hints, and a vocabulary of unnameable, inscrutable, and unspeakable closes down over the centres, over the needed centres of motivation for a dramatization of freedom and law and innocence and guilt, far more so than The Scarlet Letter did 10 years earlier. What had happened to Hawthorne's nerve and skill? As a young man during his courtship of Sophia Peabody, his letters are full of disgust for earth, by which he meant dirt, excrement, and sex. Those are his words. What delusion, he writes, can be more lamentable and mischievous than to mistake the physical and material for the spiritual? Sophia ought to live not on earth, but in paradise. And he will live with her on a cloud and walk with her just 6 inches above, I quote, the mud and mire. Throughout his work appears the figure of a woman who is sexually, physically attractive, in whose orbit men become ineffective, impotent, criminal, and depraved. This witch exercises her free craft under the surveillance of a judge figure, or some embodiment of law. These figures act within communities of fixed law, which license the judge to operate and punish. But this relationship is complicated by another relationship between the superior man or woman and the judge in his community, between the artist, the scientist, the intellectual on the one hand, and on the other, the society of the majority, with law as their representative. The witch figure in Hester Prynne, Miriam Schaefer, and Zenobia is partly an artist, wholly an intelligent, special, beautiful, dark woman. The scientist in Roger Chillingworth, the reformer in Hollingsworth, and numerous other figures in the fiction exercise their power over other people by their specialness, their will, their understanding. Hawthorne is concerned with the nature of these relationships, and he works out a series of variations on them, but never simplifies them or brings them to severely one-sided moral judgment conclusions, except in the case of a person who totally exists as a power tyrant: Chillingworth, Ethan Brand, and others, men of cold intellect, lacking in heart or fellow feeling. Judgment is solely against this person, who deserts the chain of human life and isolates himself in power over someone else, the unpardonable sin committed by a devil in human form. But even here, clearly Hawthorne cannot be simple, because the artist, the intellectual, and the scientist are always exerting power over others, are always in some way different, probably superior, not by moral standards, but by those of their profession, their craft, their art, their ability. Implied everywhere in Hawthorne, therefore, is the ideal person of heart and head, the superior sensibility who is also humanely part of his society. If you say, you can say if you like, that Hawthorne is playing over and over again, in varying embodiments, his own drama of pride and punishment. But you must add that his dilemma is that he has no fixed traditional moral standard and is certainly skeptical of the Christian moral code. His exhaustion is that of a man dramatizing situations which obsess him with their moral conflicts. His retreated, recluse characters, Fanshawe, Aylmer, Coverdale, Pynchon, delineate his satisfaction with that position. They're crippled and defeated, as Chillingworth is. Hawthorne's dilemma is American, is America's, on the eve of the Civil War of 1860, of which Hawthorne, at the age of 56, would be a spectator. He was skeptical of politicians in American democracy and said that after the Civil War, I quote, one bullet-headed general will succeed another in the presidential chair. But at least it would be real and not a fake regard for the welfare of the state. Slavery was the central issue of the Civil War, and Hawthorne tried to remain skeptical and independent on this issue too. He opposed slavery, but feared emancipation would produce a worse condition. Whereas Emerson and Thoreau held John Brown a martyr, Hawthorne saw him for the fanatic and murderer he in fact was. He believed that the Southern states did have certain rights under the Constitution, but when the Civil War came, he visited Lincoln in Washington and visited both Union and Confederate prisoners. Since the war had come, he thought the South should be defeated and then expelled from the Union to go its own way. He wrote an article, I quote, chiefly about war matters for the Atlantic Monthly in July 1862, so detached that the editor suppressed passages of it and criticized Hawthorne's saying of John Brown, nobody was ever more justly hanged. But it's Lincoln who seems nearly to have been Hawthorne's ideal man, the human intellectual man of action and contemplative leadership. And there's a long description of his idealization from the physiognomy of Lincoln to his speeches, in which he's praised his embodiment. Hawthorne died while he was working on his last fiction, The Dolliver Romance. And here again he's still taking up his central obsessive themes, the man in search of knowledge, the distilling of virtue from waste, and evil in the search for the renewal of the self. In this case, it's an apothecary who is over 70. He drinks regularly from a cordial given to him by a stranger and thinks of making it up himself and selling it commercially. But it contains one element he doesn't know. But the story turns on the greedy swallowing of this elixir of life by an old colonel and his deathly return to youth. An allegory, in fact, of the personal use of natural resources, which will become property, and the feeble will of the scientist in contact with the retired military man. But the bulk of his stories concern the duplicity of the artist, scientist, and analytical thinker and maker. Hawthorne's confirmed egalitarianism opposes the analytical monsters of the head, where he locates authoritarian power, which is sometimes shown manipulating the masses. Sometimes it amounts to anti-intellectualism and a pastoral yearning for a common folk community of craft, intelligence, and creativity among the common people in a pre-Puritan idyll. In his preface to his children's book, a wonder book, he asks, is not the human heart deeper than any system of philosophy? He strongly inherits the Puritan sense that the body, senses, sexual activity is depraved and must be transcended. But he has not the belief in the full Christian context for his feeling. So he's left dramatizing secular versions of guilt and outlawry. And he is a full, sceptical representative of the decline of the hold of Calvinism in transcendental New England culture. I think we'll just leave it at that.